Hi everybody. Now hopefully we are going to have some fun. And we have five volunteers who are going to take us through their picks for shipping industry, etc., etc. So I think we're just going to start straight down the table to get everybody started. If you could either say something that you're interested in, a stock pick, a market that you think is going to do well. If you've got a market you think is going to do especially badly, that's good too. In a stock that could be controversially badly, that would be great. So let's start, Ken.
Hi, I'm Ken Hexter from Bank of America. I cover air freight and surface transportation and shipping. I've been on the panel with Mr. Bugby many, many times, but a long time ago, so appreciate you having me back. I guess we are most excited about product carriers. There's nothing I love more than product carriers. I was told that my seat would fall down if I didn't answer that in that particular way. No, just look, we think obviously what's going on in the shipping market right now is, you know, obviously exciting times. I don't know what the right word is. Just really special times in terms of what you're seeing, right? Just where you've got in the product and crude side, you've got a relatively low order book, but and lengthening ton mile demand. And so you can see that in the rates. The question that we debate back and forth, right, is how long that lasts for and how early do investors start to discount when they start to see a rising order book on stock prices, but still a very really great time in for the companies to delever. It's taken us a decade to get here. I think we saw a ton of IPOs in the mid-2000s, where we had so many IPOs, and we're finally kind of getting to the other side of that, where you've gotten the deleverage from when they were all penny stocks a couple of years ago. So these are, like I said, exciting times for the sector. The container side is going through a different pace, where you've just got such an abnormally high order book that you're even with what's going on in the Red Sea and the lengthening length of hauls, you've seen rates come all the way back down today, I think, to where they were almost back before some of these issues crept up. So obviously a much disparity between the market. But look forward to the panel. Robert, appreciate you having me.
That thank you, Ken. That's pretty close to a 10 out of 10. Pretty close. One caveat there on the order book, 9.5 maybe. But Liam.
Hi, I'm Liam Burke. With B. Riley Financial. This is my second tour with Robert. Hopefully we'll be able to do more. We do like the dry bulk space in particular, but we think you can pick and choose your spots in the container market, despite the fact everything Ken said was true about where short-term rates were going. One of the things I do find interesting about the crises in both the Panama Canal and the Red Sea is the fact that it is being viewed by investors is temporary, and which is a fair comment. What I don't think, or what I'd like to emphasize, is the fact that the cash flows generated by these excess rates, and this is across the board when you're looking at dry bulk tankers and containers, is elevated rates drive excess cash, and across the board, the operators have been using that cash for shareholder-friendly, either returning cash to shareholders or accelerating debt reduction. So rates may be temporary, Lord knows for how long, but we've got good cash flow here.
Great. Frode?
Yeah. Frode Mørkedal, I'm from Clarkson Securities. I like tankers. I like dry bulk. I don't like LPG. Car care is not on the list either. So like in tankers, if you're going to topics or... Yeah.
Whatever you want to do, it's your time. Your rope that you could hang yourself by.
Right? Well, let's say crude tankers, I would say DHT or Frontline, very good two picks. Even if the stocks are up a lot since the bottom, you know, stock market is not pricing in that much in terms of day rates, actually. I was looking at DHT, if you buy it today, and you assume like a normalized earnings multiples, you don't have to believe in more than 45,000 per day in VLCCs. Frontline is a bit more expensive, but it's similar, 53,000 per day is priced in my reckoning. So meaning that you don't have to believe in more than, let's say, 50,000 per day or higher in order to see higher stock prices. So I think the odds are very good still.
Good. So they just need to earn what a tiny, small product tanker needs to earn at the moment then?
Product tankers are very good. I mean, I like Scorpio and Hafnia.
That's excellent. That's enough. Okay. It's an armor.
Thank you. Omar Nokta from Jefferies. I will preface by saying also Scorpio is one of our top picks. I think, you know, we across the board, we like tankers for sure. We like LPG. But I think dry bulk is the one that we think is most interesting. Clearly, it's been on a tear this year, and it started to emerge in September, October last year. But I think what's most interesting is that dry bulk has improved. We had a very strong fourth quarter beyond expectations. 1Q is off to a better start than anyone anticipated. But I think what's most interesting is even though the stocks have done well, it doesn't feel like the sector is owned. You know, talking with institutional investors, it's a sector that I think is the best is yet to come in terms of valuation, especially as the companies all start to report earnings. For the next couple of quarters, they're going to start screening better. And I think you're going to attract a wider investor audience as the year progresses.
Oh, I feel like I need to say something different.
That's just how I am.
But so I generally agree with everything that's been said. I would say if I was a few months ago, I wrote this report that where I outlined five stocks that I think could triple in 3 years. Now, it would be asinine to say that any shipping stock is going to do anything in 3 years because that would be just a pure guess. However, I think if you broaden or a little elastic with your definition of shipping, there are some interesting things. One that was on my list that you might appreciate was the Cadeler, which is offshore wind. I think that has real long-term growth potential. And offshore drilling, I think, is, again, not really shipping, but early stages of a longer-term development. So how's that for different?
I think that's great.
Yeah.
Very good. I just wanted just to pick up this difference you two have on the LPGs. So who's going to defend their position first and the other can follow?
All right. Do I talk the bullish part and you do the bearish?
Yeah.
All right. I think, you know, LPG had a fascinating year last year, driven by U.S. exports growing 20%, completely sucked in all the new build capacity that the market was afraid of. You've had the Panama Canal situation sort of exacerbated the tightness in the market. But what we think is interesting is the U.S. liquids are continuing to grow at a high rate. The U.S. crude production has liquids coming with it. U.S. natural gas is too wet. There's liquids there. All that needs to export. The U.S. has peaked in terms of propane and LPG consumption. That happened years ago. So every incremental barrel of LPG doesn't have a home in the U.S. It has to get moved. And so I think exports this year so far are running at up 6% relative to last year. The fleet's growing 6% this year, and we're just now exiting the soft part of the U.S. export season. So I think the order book is fairly tight for the next 3 years relative to what we had last year, and growth in volumes is going to continue.
Okay, I disagree. So if you look at the U.S. propane exports, at least the EIA are predicting a slowdown, just 2 million tons next year. And the whole NGL space is, you know, slowing down, right? And the primary source of LPG is actually natural gas processing, and the natural gas prices are way down. So there's less exports, at least if you just believe the U.S. government. At the same time, you have the order book, which is coming, and you had the Panama Canal, which has been very supportive. And next year, most likely, the Panama Canal is back to normal. And then rates are going lower, for sure, I think.
Hmm. For sure, you think.
Very
sure.
Brave. Frode is being extraordinarily brave, considering his CEO, Andy Case, has been right at the forefront of a lot of LPG new building orders, right? So that's a brave call.
Well, I'm talking about the stocks. So when the rates are going down, I think the stock market is pricing it up lower. So
that shows the Chinese walls in Clarkson's, right? It's excellent.
Sure.
Liam, dry cargo. You mentioned dry cargo. Are we ready? There's been some starts and stops over the last
On the dry bulk?
18 months, yeah.
They have, as Omar pointed out, and I agree with him, that the stocks have performed pretty well. Two we like in the space are Genco, which goes across the board on minor and majors. But a good way, we think, if you really believe in the space, despite the China overhang, wherever expectations ebb and flow, has been Seanergy, where you get a Capesize pure play. And if you like the space, you get the full leverage of that by having a Capesize concentration.
Ken, have you... there's a question I want to ask you or anybody. If we look at the stocks, it looks as if the crude oil stocks are performing much better than stocks, than let's say the product stocks are. Is the hope justified in crude, and is the fear justified in products?
Interesting. It definitely feels that the crude, it feels like the can keeps getting kicked down the road, at least for VLCCs. But you can always make the bullish case because production outside of OPEC is growing significantly, especially this year in the Atlantic Basin. But what seems to be happening is OPEC keeps cutting production ahead of that. And so VLCCs continue to get stunted. And eventually they'll be in higher demand. But it does feel that the VLCCs are in a holding pattern. But the midsize does very well.
Mm-hmm. I think it also has to do with maybe what's available for investors, right? In terms of, I think, the liquidity aspect of where they're focused. When they think of shipping, do they naturally just think of crude and the capability to invest? Mm-hmm. There's still, even all these years later, I think still an education in terms of the dichotomy within the market. Maybe not in this room, mm-hmm. but when we go out and talk to investors, who's paying attention still to shipping, given what's happened over the past decade? And then are they even taking the time to understand the difference then between the carriers, what their specialties are, who's got contracts, who's operating in spot, who's got liquidity, or who's got debt? Or is it just what names do they know,
yeah.
what names that are liquid enough to invest in? And that becomes, I think, a barometer of where they're
heading. So here the front lines and the NATs have got sort of a boost from how well they did in the past. Is that...
Well, NAT, when you cut dividends like that, that might be a constraint on your ability to get future investors. But I think that's a fair,
Well, frontline then, definitely.
Frontline, yeah. yourself as a in terms of cap. There's some names that are out there that are just in the discussion when you're talking about liquid crude product. And then, when you start getting down to... the dry that you're talking about, there's one or two names that institutional investors will have the discussion with. It's harder to get down to the smaller, less illiquid names.
So someone mentioned it earlier today, but I can't actually remember the last kind of new company that went public in shipping. I mean, the 2000s, there were like loads by this point. Two, three, four, five, it almost...
It happens all the time in Oslo, though.
In Oslo. but I thought Oslo was coming over here now, right?
There was a period. Look, I mean, when you think about it, again, institutional investors and the amount of, with that 42 IPOs, I think in a two-year period, self-dealings, paying themselves in terms of each vessel that was built, there was self-payment. I think those things constrained... And the speed with which, the market changed from a bullish market to a very bearish market. And then you went into very heavy debt loads that it took time for the ships to get delivered. And then you thought you'd quickly pay down some of the debt. And everybody was then figuring out, how do I refinance what was on my balance sheet? So it took even longer. You were further down the value chain as an equity holder. I think that scarred a lot of ability to access a lot of investors. I think the speed with which now they've recovered, if you think, I think Ted on our last panel was talking about how you had 10 years of nothing in containers and then 2 years of a bull market that took what could have been 20 years of profits. You know, when you change the dynamics, it's going to take investors some time to understand, have you gotten rid of that self-dealing that was going on at, you know, the decade ago? You've gotten new managements, or they've merged and consolidated. I think that has changed the tenor to where the upper echelon now have become more investables for those investors, and it starts to take time to win those investors back. But you certainly have hedge funds and that are more active and willing to look at the group. It's going to take, you know, the education process to get the larger institutional investors to recognize that, you know, it's changed and we're at that more steady state of cash flow earnings than you had been.
So now we've got some market caps in some of these names. Do we think we're going to see more M&A activity or more new issues? Or are we going to see both?
It would be great if there were new issues for all of us. That's not
that
really
makes sense.
Yeah. So, but I think the reality of it is, it gets back to what Ken was saying earlier. If you look at the names that have the most liquidity, largely they're the largest, and also they tend to be the ones that are trading closest to their net asset value. Anything that is sub, I don't know, a billion, tends to have a very heavy discount against it with respect to its valuation because, again, in a highly cyclical business where generally the people that are looking at it are looking to make a trade and not a long-term investment, they need to be able to get in and out. And it's not easy to do a $3 or $4 billion IPO in shipping. In theory, there's some family offices or businesses that could do it, but there's just not many. So your candidates, if you want to come public, are going to have to be willing to accept a really draconian value. It's a tough ask.
Okay. Any?
I think we talked about this in the last panel 6 months ago at Capital Link, where in my early days as an analyst in the mid-2000s, the NAV was always this, what we would say was a support level for the stocks. And so when I would have a conversation with an investor that asked me what's the downside, I'd say, well, the NAV is X, so at least we know that it can bottom there. Now NAV seems to continuously be this target, or you're at 1x. Your best valued companies tend to be at 1x. And I think part of that is simply because you don't have a demand story in shipping. It's all supply, which is great. The supply side is extremely tight and promising. But back 20 years ago, it was all about demand and emerging markets and China and all that. We're missing that. And until we have a really compelling demand story, I think it's going to be hard for the valuations to suggest there's a lot of new issues coming.
Also think on the M&A side, Robert, you have to have a willing seller. And with rates so high, these smaller cap companies are looking to higher rates, to higher cash flow, to be able to add to the fleet. Now, asset values are obviously elevated, and they can buy one or two at a time. They can't get massively bigger, but I think they can make a case that they can pursue a strategy to get larger without having to be boosted by a larger company to come in to supplement their fleet. So the M&A side makes sense for all the reasons we talked about on getting bigger, but again, you have to have willing sellers who are convinced they can get bigger on their own.
All right, great. So
also, given the volatility in the market that you've lived through, right? It's what do investors want to live through as long-term investors versus traders, and then the liquidity comes into play. And I think that's really important. When on the last panel we heard from the container shipping story used to be multiples of GDP growth, to Omar's point. Now it's GDP, global GDP growth. So you've had that downsize in there. So investors, I think you've seen more and more private equity carriers come in and buy up assets in the sector. We saw, a couple container liner lessors go, container ship lessors go private. because that's where, you know, they're willing to take that volatility with the large cash flow rewards that come over a consolidated period of time. But you have to be able to live through that other period, and it becomes harder to finance those vehicles in some of those down periods. But private equity may be able to handle some more of those. So I think that's why you've had that constraint of, is it right for the public markets, or is it right for staying private? And that tussle continues, I think, to this day.
Okay. So this actually has come from a somebody in the audience. I think it's a good question. And I'm going to add my own twist on it. Excluding Scorpio. Okay, so really you're getting this for free. Okay. Pick a company or a market that you have conviction on, either down or up, and tell us what you think is most misunderstood or what people are missing.
Ben, you get to start. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll go with Cadeler. You guys have an investment in that, right? I think, again, it's offshore wind. It's a little bit different. But they are ships. I was on one 2 weeks ago in Amsterdam. I think the challenge, I think, for the public markets at the moment is it's been nothing, especially in the U.S., it's been nothing but negative headlines. But the reality is there are pockets of assets that are just doing better every single week. And as you extrapolate those cash flows out a few years, in their case, they have 4 vessels in the water, and they will have 11 in 3 years' time. Their EBITDA is going to more than triple, and a lot of that's already contracted. But at the moment, it's hard to get past, you know, all of the whatever projects that have been canceled or have cost overruns or whatever. I think that is a misstep, though. I think there's a lot more upside in that,
okay,
in that sector.
It's great.
An overlooked sector we have. Oh, you want
to? No, go. It's fine.
An overlooked sector that we like, mentioned earlier on the offshore production, is the OSV market. Small. The supply side is very favorable. The demand side is quantifiable with the amount of projects that are out there, and it's a tiny overlooked sector that we do have conviction in.
One thing I think the investors have misunderstood is the cycle. Like, take tankers again.
I just want to, for those people who don't know you, Friday, you've been really out there, right over the edge, skis over the edge on the product and the crude market, which I commend you for.
Thank you.
So you've been right there, so you've got the right to go for it now, right?
Yeah, sure. So let's say, if you look at the VLCCs, again, I can take the products afterwards, but...
It's okay, I know. You have to go back to Oslo and tell John Fredriksen that you did good for the boys. It's okay.
You have just one new build coming this year and 5 next year. And everybody's very short-sighted. Like, nobody is really willing to believe that this cycle has legs, if that's the right word. But if you have just 5 or 6 ships coming over the next 2 years, and if you look at the demand side, 1 million barrels per day from U.S. Gulf is 57 ships, to be exact, if it goes to China. And just if you look at the Q1 this year, the IEA predicts that the U.S. Gulf or Atlantic, so U.S., Brazil, Guyana, are going to produce 1 million barrels per day more from Q1 to Q2. Right, so that's 57 ships. There's no ships coming in the meantime. So what happens to day rates when there are no ships available? You have to speed up, right? And then you have the same regulations that are basically mandating speeds to stay low, right? So effectively, rates have to go much, much higher than people can imagine to actually induce people to speed up, to increase supply of ships. So I think rates are going to be much, much higher than people actually dare to believe. And again, as I said initially, it's like 50,000 per day is priced in. So the risk reward is quite good, I think.
Margie Gore?
Omar Khan?
Sure, I'll mention misunderstood stock, perhaps, is Zim. The stock was, we were talking about containers in your first comments. The the market was dead on its back in December. Zim was a $6 stock facing a cash crunch, even though it has on the balance sheet $22 a share of cash on a $6 stock. There was concern that they were going to eat through all that cash over the next couple of years. They've gotten this substantial spike in freight rates. But when we look at the stock price now, it's gone from 6 to 11. So it's up 5, meaningful return. However, the $5 that has gone up is basically the earnings swing from mid-December until today. There's no one's willing to put a premium or even visibility out to this, the strength in container rates lasting beyond today. And so if rates are stronger tomorrow, that's good news for them, and they, or if they hold up. But the market, I think what's misunderstood is freight rates were at basically below cash cost for a liner. They skyrocketed on a short squeeze. They've since started to ease, and it seems like most everybody expects that that's it. This is the trend is going to continue to go down with no volatility. And I think that's where there's potential for surprise, that you just get one update in the SCFI, and it reminds people, wait a second, this market really is much tighter than we think it is. And Zim, with its spot exposure, is really the best way to play that.
I'll stick with the industry like Frode talked about in terms of the tanker side as the leading side. I think that's where you get a lot of disbelief that there's sustainability in what's going on with rates, and I think that flow through will really carry through to some of the carriers. And then I'd throw at you the more domestic, but the tank barge industry in the U.S. Is another good one. Smaller, but
yeah, good play. That's okay. That's good. All right. We've got like 13 minutes, so questions from the audience. Come on, one of these guys must have lost you money, right, over the last two, three years, and, you know, you can go for a critique or someone's trying to... Yes?
What's the current influence of the so-called dark fleet
on the ships that are off the using Russian oil, etc., on prices? So the question here is, what is the influence of the dark fleet? That is off trading to Russia on prices, or the general influence on it? Someone like to take that one?
It's been incredibly beneficial to pricing, and you've got a fleet that's getting older that is kind of removed from different trading, and you've got different trade lanes that are increasing length of haul. It's just been, you know, it's kind of sustaining the pricing story that we're seeing in the marketplace.
Yes.
So my question would be on your take on the capital allocation strategy of most companies, especially the dividend policy. What do you think about those? I mean, obviously, companies make a lot of money now. They return substantial amounts back to shareholders. What do you think about that?
So Don Nicholas asked, what's the analysts' panel's take on various capital allocation policies and dividend policies, etc.?
One of the things that has stood out is the variable dividend program that some of the operators have gone through, where if you change the price of your dividend or vary it from time to time, people will say you're cutting the dividend, we have no way to predict it. Now we're seeing more and more often a baseline dividend or a dividend level, and then investors accepting the fact that based on the seasonality or cyclicality of the particular business, that a lower or higher dividend would be in a normal course and not punishing the stock. So in terms of dividends specifically, I think that's a change, and it will continue to help the operators to allocate their returning cash to shareholders in a measured manner. We can use International Seaways as an example. That's one of the examples that would do it.
I think most investors need the higher dividend just to, again to back to the shipping cycle. Nobody dares to believe in this to last, so they actually, you know, need a high cash return to de-risk their investments. So that's the way it is today, basically.
It does geography matters very much in that conversation. It doesn't surprise me at all that someone in Norway says that investors need a high dividend, because that's the mentality, in my experience, of Norwegian investors. I don't know that that's necessarily a mandate as much for U.S. investors. I think, in fact, unquestionably, buybacks are more tax efficient than our dividends. Investors can choose as to when they want to take or to be taxed on those investments. So I think if you're in Oslo, you better have a dividend program. If you're not, well, maybe you could do buybacks, or maybe you could reserve a whole lot of cash, because at some point, and nobody wants to talk about this now, but at some point we're going to go off a cliff somewhere. I forgot who told me that over there. But you're going to go off a cliff, and when you do, you want to have a lot of money to buy all of the distressed assets that you can cobble together at the right time.
We've already lived through the full payout model, and it doesn't work in shipping. Just given the volatility of rates, given the volatility, the need to use that capital for other reasons, whether it's refreshing the fleet over time or whatever, the full payout model is the end of the company in terms of you're overcommitting capital at typically a peak rate when you need that capital at different points in the cycle. So it's good to have a steady basis that you're paying a dividend. Investors can invest in it, but I think they're basically, you know, whether it's a special dividend or they're trusting you to figure out the time to reinvest that capital. I think that's what they're looking for. That's why you get the questions on every conference call.
Every conference
what's
call.
What's your every dividend conference. Policy? When are you going to pay out? Are you going to pay out a special dividend? Are you going to buy back stock?
I will say, though, that Torolov told his new model, and it kind of makes sense to me, is you go buy assets at the right time, and you never add to that asset base. You treat it like a depleting annuity. So you go buy them, and hopefully you do it at the right time. You pay out everything that comes in, and you sell them at the end, and rinse and repeat with a completely different company. And that's a way to avoid trying to deploy capital at the wrong time.
Good. Well, what's in interest then was these Norwegian companies come to the U.S. Stock Exchange shortly, right?
Sure.
Let's see. Anybody else have a question, please?
Robert.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, the order book isn't delivered yet, so the fleet growth is just 1% as we speak. It will be 10, 11, 12% next year. So it's somewhat ahead of us. At the same time, you had the car manufacturing also slowing down. So it's been a big ramp up already from the COVID era. So you don't have much growth going forward. I think the consensus, according to the S&P, which did a survey of the manufacturing, is like 3% growth in car production and also exports, so by definition. So you have a quite meaningful slowdown in car exports at the same time as you have fleet ramping up. And add on the new EU tariffs that they are proposing. It's not looking that good. We don't know the tariffs yet, but so one thing that most people are bullish on is that they have these long-term contracts with the OEMs, but history has shown that those contracts are not very long-lasting when things change.
Anybody else? Okay, we just have a couple of minutes left. So what are you... if you take the markets that you're most bullish in, what do you think could go wrong? What are you most worried about for the next year?
The only thing that could go wrong in tankers is the oil price for some reason going down a lot. Then that would change
things.
The OSV market, a lower oil price, makes the offshore projects less economic. Some hard decisions have to be made. That would put a risk to it. In terms of the dry bulk, China is always a wild card.
Why would the lower, if lower oil prices, because suddenly OPEC fall apart, why would the crude oil tankers go down?
No, that would be good, of course, if you have that scenario. But if oil prices go down for demand reasons,
that would be bad. Okay.
Then they need to cut. But like in dry bulk, as you mentioned, I don't think the China risk is that important anymore. It used to be very important that China grew a lot, right? Because you had a very strong fleet growth. Fleet growth is now essentially very low levels. So you don't have, it's not that big a risk anymore.
I agree with you on the supply side, but I think China is still a major influence on the amount of volume that the dry bulkers ship, both on the major and the minor side. It is something that's going to be a pervasive risk.
Sure. But yeah, I guess this year you have seen Capesize rates being very strong. It's not really, you know, global iron ore volumes are actually flat, but it's just you've seen a shaping of the trade. Brazil has ramped up, Australia is down, so they cancel each other, but you had average miles increased tremendously. So nothing has changed really on the demand side in China in terms of steel, etc., but still the market is up.
I think there's a host of things that could come that would be detrimental, right? You could have peace in not that that's detrimental, that would be a great thing, but peace in Russia and Ukraine and in Israel and Gaza, and you could have shipping return to a regular trade lanes, and so that shortens some length of hauls instead of lengthening length of hauls, so you're artificially adding capacity in terms of what's out there. You could have demand. Expectations are for a pretty big second-half ramp back in demand. You could have demand not materialize, and that's, you know, the whole debate about whether the Fed's going to cut rates as we move through the year, or is it going to stay high? So you've got, you know, inflation concerns or not. You've got a lot of elections going on around the world. I think there's an abnormally high number of elections, right? So just different policies that could change that demand tact. But that's really, you know, if we're talking about a supply-demand market, anything that shakes that demand side, the supply side, I think we've established is pretty set in terms of what's coming. So the demand side, obviously, is the biggest risk factor.
Good. Omar?
I'd say Ben. I think Ken, that was a good point, obviously, on Russia, Ukraine. That's been hugely supportive. But I think also kind of what Frodo's talking about, if we have an oil demand crunch and that impacts refining, the refining market, that's been a huge boon for tankers in general. Refineries globally are running at a very high utilization, and that's creating a lot of crude inputs, product exports, and also LPG volumes. And so I think a big risk is if refineries can't pass on crude prices, that becomes a problem.
I'll add on to what Ken was saying. I think we're in very much of a populist environment where you get extreme characters that show up in locations that have the ability to do extreme things. And that is hard to predict. And for example, what if there were... What if things were to really heat up between China and Taiwan? I mean, that would be, I think it would be pretty devastating to almost every aspect of shipping. And hopefully it doesn't happen, but that's the definition of a black swan is these things that are hard to predict, but sometimes they do. So that's sort of, again, I don't know whether that keeps you up at night because there's nothing you can do about it, but probably is a good idea to not have too much debt on your balance sheet.
Mm-hmm. Well, guys, thank you very, very much. I'd just like to thank you especially for coming over from Norway. And also, I think that was very brave of you to risk your health by actually contemplating that the crude market could be weak, even thinking that, right? So everybody, thank you so much. It's been great. Thanks.